7, contact tower 128.15.
Caution, caution. Manual, fuel, manual, fuel.
I'm John Golia.
I'm Greg Fife.
And I'm Todd Curtis.
And we are the Flight Safety Detectives.
Between us, we have over a century of aviation accident investigation and safety experience to draw on as we discuss issues that affect all of us.
So we are qualified to share our perspectives on accidents and incidents and what can be learned from them for the future.
We're proud to say that we have two sponsors that really relate to the topic of aviation safety: the Professional Aviation Maintenance Association, or PAMA, and Avemco Insurance. Later on in the show, we'll tell you how you can get a 5% discount on your insurance just for listening to the show.
We don't just dissect the official reports. In every episode, we identify safety issues and take the mystery out of accident investigations.
So maybe pilots and their planes can have safer flights ahead.
Well, hello, gentlemen. It is another episode of Flight Safety Detectives. So it's always good to see you. I know that it's been a while since the three of the band of merry men have been together, but we have an interesting event that recently took place in relation to when we're recording the show. It was a Cessna 172 that was on, I won't call it a night cross country because we're not really sure what the purpose of the flight was, but they were doing a night flight. It was a flight instructor with a 17-year-old student pilot who had departed out of Long Island and apparently was headed for Stuart Newburgh Airport in upstate New York. And part of the flight was crossing over water. And then the accident or the event, because we can't really call it an accident because it was a controlled event, ended up in a ditching in the Hudson River. And I know, Todd, that when you started researching this accident, you got all of at least the initial history of flight type information. We were looking at ADS-B data with the flight path. And I know, John, I've flown in and out of there a number of times, but only during the day. And I know that you're very familiar with that area. So we'll hold that until we get to it. But Todd, why don't you introduce our audience to at least the facts as we know them, or the storyline that we know right now, because the NTSB and the FAA are early in their investigation, so we're not really sure with what the purpose of the flight was and what the, quote, mechanical problem was with the engine, other than the fact that the pilot reported to the tower controller at Stewart that he had an engine problem.
Well, this is a flight that took off from Islip Central, Long Island, proceeded to the northwest toward the Hudson River. In fact, crossing the area north of New York City in a fairly developed area with a lot of roads. And I say that because it would appear that this aircraft, and you can see from the graphic on the, for those of you watching the video version of this, it wasn't going from apparently in a straight line from, let's say, waypoint to waypoint. It looks as though that landmarks on the ground were a major feature of this flight, including a good portion of the flight flying up the Hudson River. Now, as they approached Newburgh, New York, which is just north of where the West Point Military Academy is, they come in for a landing, do apparently a stop and go, take off again, and start heading back down the river, back presumably toward Long Island, and I say presumably because we don't have a full statement from the pilot, when, for reasons that are as yet unknown, the aircraft made a turn back toward Newburgh and kept its altitude and airspeed fairly constant. But as they got close to the airport, roughly 6 miles or so from the closest runway, the aircraft began to reduce airspeed, and shortly after that made a turn away from Newburgh toward the Hudson River, where it landed, as we said before, on an ice flow of some sort in the Hudson River, and the two occupants were able to leave the aircraft. Now, why this was the situation, we really don't know. But as you said before, there are a lot of things to question about this. One of them being, this was a night flight. It took off after the end of civil twilight, and there was a moon out, but it was fairly low to the horizon, less than 30 degrees off the eastern horizon. So it would have been to their right as they were flying up the Hudson. And it's unclear what sort of navigational references they were using. There were fairly high hills and low mountains on the range of 1,200 feet or so, one of which was directly in their flight path during the approach, which they flew over twice, once going to the airport and once returning to the airport. This was not a flight path for an ILS or a localizer approach. This was a visual approach at night. It's a fairly easy night. Clear sky, light winds from the south, and it was cold. It was around 25 degrees Fahrenheit, about -3 Celsius. But the weather was not limiting in any way, in my opinion. And the final turn, and those of you looking at the graphic again, you see that there was a fairly gentle, by comparison, 180-degree turn south of West Point. As it got closer to the airport and made a turn away from the airport toward the Hudson, there was a much more radical 180-degree turn, and from what little ADS-B data we have, it got to as low as 64 knots ground speed before the aircraft landed in the Hudson.
When we look at this storyline, John, you know, you preach it at the end of all of our shows, and that is pre-flight. And flying a single-engine airplane at night is a lot different than flying a single-engine airplane during the day for a whole variety of reasons. But the biggest reason, especially in a training environment where you have a flight instructor and a student, the student is early on. They do have a requirement to log at least 3 hours of night flight. But coming out of that busy airspace and having to be low, and it, based on the ADS-B data, they never got above 2,000 feet. And that's 2,000 feet MSL. That's not AGL. So it's, you know, in some spots sufficiently lower. The fact is that you really have to plan your route of flight for the very fact that if you have to put the airplane down, where are you going to do that? And that all is part of the pre-flight exercise that not only as a flight instructor you want to know, because you're the pilot in command and you're going to be making that decision if you do have to divert somewhere, but you're trying to instill on a student pilot good operating principles and practices, especially, you know, flying at night. And I know that you're familiar with that area and looking at all of this data as well. You know, there was a number of options that this pilot, the flight instructor, and the student could have taken, but they chose to head off into a hilly, mountainous area where, while there are city lights and there are some ground references, there's a lot of, quote, black holes out there that when you look at a Google Earth map or you view the area during the day, those are trees. And so it didn't afford, you know, a real good plan B heading to that airport at a low altitude.
You know, when I look at the track coming up on Long Island, he crosses Long Island Sound fairly close to New York City, and he going up on the northwest paths. He comes in south of White Plains, so that's around Scarsdale and Westchester County. Very hilly terrain, a lot of roads, though, but very hilly terrain, so a lot of lights. And he crosses over the river and the reservoir that's there. I forget the name of the reservoir. And then he proceeds up the river for a little bit, and then he starts climbing over the very hilly terrain on the west side of the Hudson, heading for the airport of Newburgh. So from the time he cleared the river till the time he got fairly close to the airport, he doesn't know what's below him. You know, West Point was further north than his original path, so there's probably a big bright spot up there because West Point is pretty well lit. And so he went uneventfully, fortunately, into that airport and did his stop and go. And on takeoff coming out, he did the turn heading south. And at that point, somewhere in there, the engine must have been running rough. Right, because in his track, he was coming back. And we don't have the timing on the air traffic control tapes But at some point on that return, he told him he had an engine failure. And he continues up the river using a nice guide path, you know, and he made his turn. That was a tough decision to make the turn. I know that he's facing the bridge in front of him. The bridge is high. And at nighttime, I wouldn't want to attempt going underneath the unlit bridge. So I can see him taking that U-turn, which is commonly called the impossible turn, because very few people can satisfactorily complete that turn. But he did. He came out of that turn very slow, 63 knots or so, hovering right around the stall speed of the airplane. But he got it down and he got it landed on the ice. So he was very fortunate, maybe lucky, or maybe skill. We don't know what his experience level is. It's one or the other. And unfortunately, nobody perished. But it raises a whole host of questions about what he was thinking at the time. Hello, aviation enthusiasts, safety professionals, and curious minds. Welcome to Flight Safety Detectives. We are thrilled that you dropped by. Here, we dive deep into the world of aviation safety. From incident investigations and technical analysis to lessons learned and what they mean for safer skies. As a member of our channel, you get exclusive member-only perks, first access to new episodes, live stream discussions, and Q&A sessions. We are a community of fellow safety detectives who love aviation as much as you do. If you're passionate about aviation or just curious about how things work, we'd love to have you on board. Hit join, ring the bell to be notified, and jump into the discussions in the comments. Strap in, because together we're going to explore aviation safety like never before.
And you bring up some good points in the fact that, you know, yeah, he was successful, at least landing at Newburgh, and then on the departure made the left turn and was heading outbound. But the brief clip of the air traffic control communication was that initially they were losing power. Okay, losing power means you still got power. And what we don't have is the fidelity and the timing, because I'd like to look at that against the ADS-B data, because depending on that location, was that location at a point where if they still had some power, you're losing power depending on their altitude, should he have made the turn and started heading directly to the airport? They were low. They were no higher than 2,000 feet. But in that area, Todd, I think you looked at it was about 300 to 400 feet as far as the geography there. So that really puts them not very high. If they're at 2,000 feet, they're only at 1,500 feet AGL. Your glide ratio in a 172, if it's optimal, is 9 to 1. So for every 9 feet forward, you're going to lose a foot of altitude. But you've got to be on your speed. And from what you showed us and what we talked about off air, he never got towards best glide speed in any way, shape, or form.
And although there was the ADS-B only gives us ground speed, not the airspeed, there were reported from the weather reports a fairly light wind from the south. And from looking at the flight tracks and the ADS-B data, it doesn't look like the pilot got even close to the best glide, which I believe in that aircraft is on the mid-60 knot range. And they were in around 85 knots, 90 knots, that sort of thing. So they would have been able to glide, certainly, but not at the maximum glide ratio.
And again, you know, we talk about pre-flight, and it's not only making sure you got a sound airplane and you as the pilot are sound to conduct the flight, but it's all about, again, flight path planning or flight planning. And in this case, John, coming out of Long Island, you know, one of the things that I always was concerned with flying at night, and I still do, I factor it in, and that is, even though it may not be the most direct route in most cases, if I'm flying when I flew my Comanche and other airplanes at night, I made a conscious decision that I was going to plan a route that at least from 5, 6, 7, 8,000 feet that I was cruising at, that there was an airport within close gliding proximity to my flight path. So if something did happen and I had to divert, I didn't have to spend a hell of a lot of time trying to find it or go to my iPad, go to my ForeFlight and go to nearest airport and then, you know, try to make decisions. Because again, you know, you got weather concerns and operational concerns with the airplane, depending on what the nature of the problem is. And I know that, you know, had they gone up the coast, you're very familiar with the coast because you're up and down that coast quite a bit. That was probably maybe even a better option.
Yeah, the route he took, you know, going across the Long Island Sound and heading up in that northwest, north of New York City, south of White Plains, well, you've got to stay low because you've got airplanes landing at LaGuardia. You got airplanes that landing at White Plains. In fact, depending on the wind, the landing pattern for White Plains is the bridge that he went over, the Tappan Zee Bridge. That's the turning point to turn into White Plains Airport. And those airplanes are down to 3,000 feet. So he took a very crowded route or obstacle, maybe not crowded, but one with a lot of obstacles that they had to pay attention to coming up, where I think if he flew on the Connecticut coast, still crossed the Sound, but flew up on the Connecticut coast, he could fly just off the coast following Christ 95, runs right along the water at that point. He could have flown that all the way up to Providence and even further. Yeah. And got his time for nighttime. So that would be a question I'd like to ask him is, why did you choose that route? Was he familiar with it and that's why he did it? Or was there some other reason?
And then, of course, looking at the mechanical operation, I know, Todd, that, you know, you're still doing a lot of flying and doing some flight instruction, receiving flight instruction. Have you done any recent night flying with
your
instructor?
Not recent at all. In fact, I was going to wait until I'm toward the end of getting my instrument rating to do more night flying. And certainly it's possible where I am. I'm just south of San Francisco. But circumstances, having a couple dogs with me, and they don't take it well when I'm away at night. So it's one of these things where not only do I have to fly at night, I have to figure out which doggy overnight care do I have to take the dogs to so I can do that.
Oh, please, just take them with you. Park them in the back seat. Let them be a critic of your flying.
They start growling at you. You'll know you're not doing something right.
That's right. Exactly. Well, you know, this event had a fortunate outcome. The flight instructor at the very end, you know, most likely made the best reasonable choice for putting the aircraft down safely under control. And as you talked about, John, you know, making that quote impossible turn, it's obvious that he had to have made that 180 degree turn at low altitude while maintaining his airspeed to maintain control, still had sufficient control to be able to put the airplane in the water safely for them to evacuate. And while that part of the story is great, we really have to understand the beginning of the story to see what the lessons learned are. Because again, Todd, you described the flight path. It wasn't like it was a night cross country going point to point to point to get to Newburgh. It was more of a, you know, okay, yeah, let's head that general direction and then we'll head another general direction and eventually we'll make it to the airport kind of thing. And so is that a prescribed maneuver or procedure at the flight school? Is that part of the training curriculum? Was that a student who planned that particular route, who was actually doing the flying through most of that flight, even into the event? I would love to understand how that the latter part of the flight took place for others to learn from. The student was flying, you know, the proper transference of controls. It's obvious the flight instructor most likely took over the aircraft at a point where they finally determined that the engine had failed, because that was a report by one of the pilots to air traffic control that the engine had failed. There are a lot of learning lessons from this, good, bad, and indifferent. And I think that hopefully the NTSB and the FAA will ask a lot of those probative questions and then publish those questions and answers so that others can learn from it. Because again, you have a night scenario. It's totally different. Single engine airplane, low altitude. And then what was the nature of the engine failure? Was it a carburetor ice issue? Was it a fuel issue? Was it some mechanical issue attributed to the operation of the engine and things like that? It was a cold night, if I remember, Todd.
It was on the surface, it was in the 20s and would have been slightly cooler at 2,000 feet. And although this event did get quite a bit of regional coverage, newspaper and television. In fact, the governor of New York State was quoted as calling this another miracle on the Hudson, harking back to, of course, Captain Sullenberger and his crew landing near New York. Now, two things they have in common. Everyone survived. They have stories to tell and lessons to learn and lessons to share. The precursor events of these two aircraft events are going to be radically different for a whole bunch of reasons, not just because it's a student pilot and airline pilot, but just a general question of, was there sufficient thought put into the process before they took off? And what parts of what transpired was a surprise to them, where they either had or did not have some sort of a plan to execute once that happened?
And that's a great way to contribute to your second to the last point as we wrap up this discussion. So with that being said, John, I'm going to leave you with our last word.
Well, and as always, because we just see the accidents where people ignore what I'm going about to say, if you're going to go flying, pre-plan. Do it before you go to the airport. Do it again at the airport. Make sure they agree. Remember to brief yourself or all of the passengers on the airplane of what to expect. If you lose an engine on takeoff, know where you're going to go before you have to go. You know, when you get out to your airplane at the airport, prior to takeoff, do a good pre-flight. If you're concerned that you might not be doing the best pre-flight, find a mechanic and ask them to show you how to do a pre-flight or what they look at, because mechanics look at airplanes different than pilots do. Ask them to show you what they look at. And after you get in the air, put that head on a swivel, because there's a lot of activity out there, a lot of students at some airports and learning how to fly, and they make mistakes. That's why you're learning. That's why you fly with an instructor. So please, it's a busy, busy place in the air today. Please fly safely.
Thank you so much for listening to the show. We really value all of our listeners and subscribers. Our podcast gets ranked by you. So if you like this, give us 5 stars inside your podcast platform.
We want to keep the conversation going with you. So we'd love for you to engage with us on our social media channels. We're on Instagram, X, Facebook, LinkedIn, and of course, YouTube.
You can email the show at flightsafetodetectives@gmail.com. By the way, if you're watching this on YouTube, we're working on growing this channel, and it really helps if you all comment. So please do that. We read them all.
And be sure to subscribe.
For decades, Avemco Insurance Company has been an advocate for pilot safety by promoting and sponsoring continuous pilot training and education. One of their initiatives has been to reward pilots who actively participate in being more proficient with savings on their insurance premium through the Avemco Safety Rewards Program. Pilots save by earning new ratings, getting recurrent training, participating in the Fast Team Wing program, and listening to podcasts like ours and other Avemco-related courses and training. Call 888 879
0389 for a free quote or visit avemco.com/flightsafety. Don't forget to tell them the Flight Safety Detective sent you for an automatic 5% off.